Hi, everyone. So right now in the United States, trials have been largely suspended because they would offend social distancing rules. That includes criminal trials. But a time may well come soon when we resume normal life but maintain social distancing rules. And much of what has taken place in person might take place virtually over, say, Zoom. How will this work if we go that route with criminal trials? It's a very interesting question whether you can do a criminal trial over Zoom or what sorts of problems you would have if you did. And to think about it, I have asked, I think, the perfect person in the country to talk to us. We're joined today by Mark Greenberg. He's a professor of law and also separately a professor of philosophy at UCLA. And he, before entering the teaching world, he worked at the Department of Justice as a deputy assistant attorney general and as a federal prosecutor. So I wanted to get his thoughts about what tricky points may be in the offing if there's some question of having criminal trials, but by Zoom. So, Mark Greenberg, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for that kind introduction, Harry.
Okay. It's not straightforward, is it, that the Constitution would have no real possible objections to a Zoom trial? No?
I definitely think that it's not straightforward. I think there's very serious constitutional issues. I divide this topic up in my own thinking into first logistical and practical challenges, technical challenges, which we could talk about. Then there's empirical questions about what would be the effects of those technical changes on a trial. For example, would they be more likely to result in getting at the truth, or would they be more likely to result in convictions or acquittals? And then we get to the constitutional question, which is quite apart from these empirical facts, which would require serious study. Would it be constitutionally permissible to conduct trials in these ways? And then there's even a moral layer of, normatively, would fairness and democracy allow us to do this, regardless of whether our actual constitution would do so? And we could jump in at different points in there.
Yeah, well, I definitely like the last two, but tell me briefly what you mean by logistical, so I know what category you're talking about. You mean technological?
Well, I think not exactly. I think it's intimately related to the constitutional and normative questions. So, for example, there's going to be a very serious question about, say, witness coaching, just to pick one topic. So in a courtroom, a witness is up there on the witness stand
Right.
in public. Suppose that a witness were at home on their laptop. How would you prevent somebody from standing behind the laptop and holding up cards or whispering in the witness's ear or from them having an earpiece? How would you, so there's coaching, there's the possibility of somebody threatening right there in the room. So how would you deal with physical evidence that normally the jury would get to see? How would you deal with jury deliberation? Suppose jurors are at home on their laptops. How would you prevent, members of their family from, doesn't have to be an evil conspiracy, members of their family from,
From
inappropriately.
kibitzing or whatever. Right. It really is, whether these unavoidable logistical issues give rise to constitutional or moral concerns. Okay, well, let's jump ahead to the Constitution and then kind of refer back to what you're calling logistical issues that might implicate it. So just for starters, are there a couple sort of big ticket provisions in the Constitution that you think we've got to chew on in figuring out the constitutionality of Zoom trials?
So I think clearly the Confrontation Clause, which gives the defendant the right to confront the witnesses against him or her, is a major issue. But also the right to jury trial. So there's a real question whether a trial on Zoom with jurors, at their own home, say, would qualify as what the Constitution demands.
Yeah, so that's right. The court is always talking about history and tradition and what was meant by jury trial in 1789. It sure wasn't 12 people separate. I mean, in fact, and you've done, you know, this as a federal prosecutor, as do I, there's a special kind of chemistry or dynamic that I think is considered desirable when you get 12 persons and you separate them out and they become, they hopefully kind of bond in a way that they, you know, they have this insulated role that they sort of reinforce the seriousness with which one another takes it. And that's, yeah, if it were on Zoom, that it sure feels like that wouldn't have the same kind of chemistry.
And let me mention two things there. One is that I don't think we have to assume that we have a pure Zoom, let's call a pure Zoom model where each participant, the judge, each juror, each witness, each counsel, each lawyer, the defense is at their own home. But we don't have to assume that it's that or a conventional courtroom trial. There's all sorts of in-between models. So just as, you know, Major League Baseball is planning to play without spectators, we could have any number of in-between models. That's why I think we can't really separate these questions from the constitutional question. We could have in-between models where, for example, witnesses testify under some kind of supervision, where jurors are watching on Zoom in a hotel room, not at their own homes, under supervision, or even you have a room with partitions where the jurors are 6 feet apart with partitions between them. So it complicates the questions.
Yeah, I'm thinking about deliberations. But the ultimate constitutional question here, I guess, there's a guaranteed a jury trial. And is this a jury trial within the meaning of the Seventh Amendment? Yes, that's what you're basically.
That's what I was thinking. And now you mentioned the special dynamic of a jury that's deliberating, and you mentioned maybe the seriousness that they feel, or that's imposed on them. But I think there's other. This is what I meant by when I said there's a group of empirical issues, because it turns out that juries aren't necessarily the best way of getting to the truth. There's been a lot of study of juries, and it seems to me there's real empirical questions about whether having juries in separate rooms would make them worse at getting at the truth, would make them better at getting at the truth. You could imagine, for example, that it could make it easier for a single holdout juror to avoid being pressured into conformity by other jurors. Mm-hmm. So from an empirical point of view, there's interesting questions that couldn't really be answered without study. But I think from a constitutional point of view, as you said, there's just a lot of faith in tradition, and there's going to be a big obstacle to overcome. One parallel area of the law dealing with sexual assault trials and child abuse cases, the court has sometimes allowed in exceptional circumstances, victims to testify on video from another room. But the court has made clear in these cases that there's a very strong, important interest of the defendant that has to be overcome by specific findings. And I think that's what the issue is going to be here. There's just a very strong interest in having that traditional empaneling of a jury.
Yeah, so it'll be hard to do it by a rule. And, you know, now that I'm thinking about it, so the confrontation clause, people know, you know, you have a right to confront witnesses. That's something that a defendant has a right to. But a jury trial, doesn't the jury trial right extend to some civil trials? So, I mean, that we could be talking about more than just criminal trials, or do I actually have that wrong?
You're right. I just think that for our purposes, we might decide to hive off criminal issues as being specially pressing. For example, we couldn't simply say, because of speedy trial requirements and so on, let's just postpone them for 6 months.
Yeah.
And because the interests of the criminal defendant are specially weighty. But yeah, there is a federal jury, civil jury.
Right. Also. And now, so you referred to the whole layer of moral questions. I suppose they also rest on empirical claims or information that we don't have yet.
Well, not necessarily. Actually, the way I was thinking about this is the following. So in our Anglo-American model puts an awful lot of faith in the adversarial model under which the defendant has a lawyer who's representing the defendant and the defendant's interest, and the prosecution is representing the government, And both sides have a real incentive to exaggerate, mislead. There are, of course, limitations on what the prosecution can ethically do. But there's a real incentive for both sides to try to win. And the idea behind this model is supposed to be that justice and truth will out by this competition. But there's another model out there. I'm very far from expert on the inquisitorial model, you might call it, that other systems have. So everything I say about it has to be taken with a caveat. But the rough idea of that model is that there's a government official who's a kind of judge, prosecutor, investigator,
right,
who has to look into the case and neutrally decide. And even the point I wanted to make is that even if it turned out empirically, I don't know what the answer is, but even if it turned out empirically that model better promoted the finding the truth, it seems to me that in a democracy, there's just something fundamentally wrong with a defendant's liberty being taken away by a kind of by a government bureaucrat like that without the defendant having the ability to defend him or herself in the way that we think of. So in other words, I'm arguing that there's a, quite apart from finding the truth, there's a kind of normative justice side of this, which could actually be used to defend our constitutional or something like our constitutional system, even if it wasn't the best system for getting at.
Yeah, so I mean, I know a little bit about this. They employ it a lot in Europe, and you can imagine a really fine civil servant with, you know, completely fair and with a lot of integrity, by and large, comes up with more accurate answers than does a jury of 12. Nevertheless, where I think you're right that it's not simply like a gamesmanship sort of thing, but an actual normative claim or precept that, you know, you get to go about making your case in the best way you can, and we can only do that by it with somebody else's pairing it. So the claim then would be that it's not consistent with it, just not fair as we have come to think it fair socially to have that kind of model.
So you just hinted at the idea that this might just be a cultural phenomenon. And look, yeah, you and I are both products of the Anglo-American system. So maybe it's just that we're so imbued with that system and its distrust of government and so on. But there's another possibility too, which is that in a democracy, the essence of which is a kind of self-government by a community of equals, that you should, well, there's different aspects. Everyone should be able to be judged by their equals, by jurors.
A jury of their peers, yeah.
There's an idea maybe that a government official, a member of the executive branch, shouldn't be able to make this kind of decision. We need a separation of power. So you can see how there might be sort of serious moral arguments rather than just a kind of cultural heritage.
Yeah. So you've provoked a lot of questions here. And I think your point is really compelling, that you know, a lot of it would just take some learning and studies, but very hard to imagine how that occurs. And even that it would occur. I know the Confrontation Clause cases that you were talking about with the court and child abuse victims, they didn't decide it by having 18 experiments with different kinds of circumstances. They just gave, in their judgment, basically said, if it's a really important interest on the one side and you make, as you say, case-specific findings, then you can compromise the principle just a little bit, etc. So it strikes me, if this actually comes up, and you know, it seems quite reasonable that it might, that we're opening up in a way that still doesn't permit resumption of what had been full court proceedings, that a court's just going to make a kind of loosey-goosey judgment on the Sixth Amendment and Seventh Amendment claims, and there'll be, I think, a kind of pressure to sanction it. You know, we may in fact, being a whole new kind of jury trial, even though we haven't made any sort of sophisticated empirical determination.
Yeah, getting down to the kind of practical, what's likely to happen, I think that it's very likely this issue will be faced. And I think it's very likely that what we're going to see is not pure Zoom trials, but some kind of intermediate structure where we have witnesses or juries under some kind of supervision, but not interacting completely freely in the normal way. And yeah, I think we're going to see, it's going to be different in different places. You might also see judges making findings that, you know, minor cases are just not, the government interest is just not important enough, and those cases get dropped. And I'm just speculating.
Or here, they stay in the ether. Yeah. Super interesting, and there'll probably be different answers in different states, but then there'll be challenges saying Idaho's answer or Pennsylvania answer violates the federal constitution. This is one of the dozens and dozens of ways in which the alteration society going forward as a result of the virus will frame, you know, unanticipated questions or issues that we'll just have to wrestle with and might even take wrong turns with, right? I think there are certainly people who would say that the court's holding with child sex abuse victims really hasn't really complied with the confrontation clause. And, you know, I can imagine that being revisited, that 5-4 decision. But whether or not it is, there's, I presume, going to be some false starts here where we're going to be doing it the best we can. And yet every time we are, there are constitutional rights on the other side.
Right. There's just no question that given the way our system works, defense attorneys will have just a huge battery of different arguments to make. You know, my client was in a different room from me, the defense attorney. And so, you know, we weren't able to whisper back and forth in the normal way. My client wasn't able to participate in his or her own defense in the normal way because of that. You know, we couldn't ask the witness whether they could see a particular sign at the back of the courtroom to show the jury what their vision was like.
Certain demeanor of fidgeting, or, you know, the camera doesn't give you everything, as we've seen in videotape depositions. Yeah, this is really quite the can of worms. Yeah,
so I think it's hugely problematic from a constitutional point of view, and it's going to be really interesting. And there's going to be, but I think there's going to be a lot of experimentation with these kind of intermediate models, courtrooms with people sitting 6 feet apart with partitions between them and so on and so forth.
Really fascinating to ponder. Okay, so Professor Mark Greenberg and Professor Mark Greenberg, both philosophy and law professor, and I think we've seen this afternoon why both are in play. Thank you very much for your time. Quite a lot to chew on here, and we may be seeing this work out in real time in the matter of months. Thanks a lot for giving us all a lot to think about where Zoom trials are concerned.
Thank you. It's been fun.